Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, pairing beer and music since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Listen critically, enjoy responsibly.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we're going to review the latest from Neil Young and from the group Salt. But first, we're going to revisit one of our shows from a few years back and talk about analog versus digital.
Greg, I think that this technology, digital technology, is now so ubiquitous, we rarely stop to think about it. I'd venture to say that everybody listening to this show is, in one way or another, hearing it digitally. Maybe it's coming over the radio. Maybe they're listening on the phone with a pair of earbuds. We are recording into a computer, and a lot of the music that we play here was recorded digitally. All of this digital technology certainly is convenient, but some people are asking, are we missing something that only analog can provide?
That's the argument being made, Jim, by Damon Krukowski. He is a musician best known for his role in Galaxy 500 back in the late 80s, early 90s, as well as Damon and Naomi, his current band, who have been guests on Sound Opinions. And he also spends a lot of time thinking about the intersection of digital and analog. Now, he explores that very subject in his new book, The New Analog. Damon recently came by our studios, and we started the conversation by defining two key concepts in his book, signal and noise.
The way I use noise in the book is the way an audio engineer uses noise, which is as distinct from what they call signal. So signal is anything you're trying to get across, the message that you want people to pay attention to. And noise, to an engineer, is everything else, which means everything surrounding that signal. Mm-hmm. And I think in analog space and time, just when you're with people, you're out in the world, you're always picking out the signal from the surrounding sounds, what you want to be paying attention to at that moment. And the rest may seem in your way, but in truth, if you think about it, you also derive a lot of information and a lot of meaning from the rest. So, for example, if you're on the street and you might be trying to listen to a conversation with your friend, you're simultaneously listening to a lot around there. You're listening to the traffic, you're listening to other people on the street.
If we were on the beach in the Bahamas doing this interview, that would be part of the noise.
Exactly. The surf crashing against the shore is a classic example. It's white noise, quite literally. In analog media, we have this joining always of signal and noise. And that's a technical concern for engineers who are making records or any other kind of recording, where you may decide, okay, I want to maximize my conveyance of the signal, say a singer's voice, and minimize the noise, say, for example, the breath that the singer might take or other sounds that might be bleeding into the mic around that voice. You can isolate things in digital media, absolutely. So you don't have to accept a certain amount of noise around the signal that you choose. And I think this is familiar to anybody from any computer process. You don't have to be in audio to think about this. Because in digital, one way we use computers, you decide what you want. Say you could, then you select it. Then you can select the rest of everything, highlight it, and delete it. And in audio, it's essentially that same process that that people might be familiar with from any number of computer
devices. You make the comparison to the iPhone. You know, in the book, there's three microphones on the iPhone. None of them are intended to make us be heard better. All of them are intended to take out where we are, basically, isolate just what we're trying to say and from where we are saying it.
Exactly, which is why it's a brilliantly engineered device that you can now speak on the phone in the most noisy environments. And that's because they have the engineers for the iPhone and for cell phones in general have figured out ways to isolate just the message of your words. I think the extreme example now is if you have an iPhone where you get a voicemail and it actually transposes the words for you into text. There it's just eliminated the voice altogether, just like gave up on the voice, the sound of the voice. Because the idea is, well, we know what the message is that you want from this device. Well, you want the other person's words. You want the meaning of their language. And so with tremendous confidence that I think the digital engineers have, they said, okay, well, then we'll just get rid of the rest. Now, the problem is that the rest may be very meaningful to us. For
As anyone who's ever tried to flirt on email knows, you can actually come across as doing the exact opposite and being insulting.
Precisely, because tone is so hard to convey through just signal. Tone, I think, is something that we understand as human beings. We're very good at it. Through noise, really. through how breathy are you being? Are you speaking to me intimately? And this is true in the studio as well. What audio engineers call proximity effect. It's a really simple idea, which is that I'm right now at a certain distance from this microphone I'm speaking into. As I move closer to the microphone, I'm not changing the level of my voice, but you're hearing it differently. And I think now I sound like a late night FM DJ from my childhood, 1975. Like they would speak really close to the mic because it accentuates the lower parts of your voice. Now, as I move further away, you'll hear the higher tones of my voice and you lose that bassy quality. And I'm not trying to change the volume of what I'm saying, but you'll hear a different quality.
Yeah.
Now, a great microphone singer like Sinatra.
He knew.
Uses that to effect. And he knows that when you lean in, you start to feel more close to the singer. And when you back away, you feel less.
When I was 35, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for blue-blooded girls of independent means. We'd ride in limousines. Their chauffeurs would drive. When I was 35.
The way we understand that in regular life is, again, it's a question of noise as well as a signal. So you're not just isolating the voice, but you are allowing the voice to be seated in a set of other sounds that add some other kind of communication to it.
What about this idea of thick listening? You take us through a Beach Boys recording and talk about all the unintentional noises that were in court. Tell us that story.
Right. Well, I use the Beach Boys as an example because of crowdsourcing online. All these people, untold Beach Boys fanatics all over the world, listening really carefully to Pet Sounds and listening between the lines, as it were, to what's going on in the studio while they're recording. Things like Brian Wilson rewinding the tape in the control booth or saying something. Famous example is two horn players chatting in the studio while they were something else was being recorded. These sounds were buried into the tape. And they went ahead and used the mix either because with them in it, either because they didn't notice them or because it didn't really matter. Because the signal was clear enough. And yeah, there were these noises down there, but wasn't really going to get in the way of a great tune or also a great recording. Because what would happen is in the analog studio, when you turn the tape on, everybody's focused, something happens. And if something slightly goes wrong, you're kind of loath sometimes to throw the take away because you can't recreate that again. And you can't just highlight the noise and eliminate it like you could digitally now. So you had to live with it. So Brian Wilson lived with a lot of inadvertent noises that are buried in the Beach Boy recordings. In the book, I call listening for those noises thick listening because I think you're listening past the obvious signal. You're listening to the noises that are also happening around it. And that includes writing, if you're listening on LP, the surface noise of your own LP, but then you're also listening to the hiss on the tape that was back in the studio, and you're also just listening to the air and the environment and the horn players chatting in the corner.
Yeah.
And that kind of attention is a special kind of attention that I think we, in the analog world, are very comfortable with and well-trained for. Yes, you're listening to the song, but you're listening to it surrounded by all kinds of other information. And by that, I would include the artwork to an LP or to a CD as well.
You make the most eloquent defense of liner notes that I've ever read. and as writers, I appreciated that. You know, we don't know who the producer was. We don't know who the third string violinist was anymore.
We hardly even know the members of the band. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because, you know, the front cover of records has made the transition to digital by being scanned and online everywhere.
And reduced postage stamp size.
Yes, it's sadly small, but at least it's there.
Yeah.
But the back cover is missing. It's just gone missing. Not to mention from the CD era, all those incredibly extensive liner notes an example I think that I run up against all the time now is that cover songs are not clearly indicated on iTunes or Spotify or anywhere else online in digital listening. So people now come to our shows and think that we wrote the songs that we covered.
Mm.
And we're routinely asked that. Oh, I love that song of yours, Listen, the Snow is Falling, which is by Yoko Ono. Can't really blame them because they haven't been given any information. And you know, I've been asked a couple times since I wrote the book, what do I think about Neil Young's idea of Pono and the sort of rumblings about making digital sound better by adding more bits to it. And to some degree, I don't discuss that in the book because really I think there's so much more other information that we've lost besides a few bits.
Yeah.
You know, I would trade. I don't need to go to 20-bit, which is 4 bits more than CDs. I just want my back covers back to the LPs. There's so
an easy man to please.
There's
really
so much information there.
Is all that, right, all right. Yeah. So it's time for me to play devil's advocate, okay. Damon. We're talking to Damon Krukowski, veteran indie rock musician, author of The New Analog. So Damon, one thing that's missing from the book is an argument. Or any sort of notion about the discovery of music or just the value. You know, you talk about how your preferred way to listen to a ball game in the book is on a crappy old transistor radio, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, and I'm sorry, you know. I went to Pure Platters in Hoboken and I bought each Galaxy 500 album as it came out, okay?
Thank you.
But some kid in Montana discovers it by accident on Spotify. He or she has just discovered a piece of art. If 9 out of 10 people are just happy to have and consume this art, makes their day a little better, fine. But it's always going to be only 1 in 10 that is so curious they will discover who you are, who you were, that you're a poet, a publisher, Naomi, your significant other is a filmmaker. Oh, they're going to go deeper, right? Isn't that how it always was? I mean, I consumed every fanzine article written about Galaxy 500, but other people just said they heard it on college radio and said,
oh, it's kind of cool.
I hear you, Jim, and I totally agree. I think actually digital has made made a better world for listening in a lot of ways, and that's one of them. I mean, the way that our music can spread around the world free, cheaply, and be really available in places we could never dream of, to me, that's an ideal. I mean, that's actually a dream. We always wanted our music to be available outside our own circle, and then really I think no musician doesn't want that because when you pick up an instrument, it's to share. It's to
it's
have
not your... completed until the person hears it.
Exactly. And I think that's true for so much art. And so in that regard, I am all for it. I'm not anti-digital at all. And I use digital files all the time. I listen to them too. It's also enabled us to travel places we could never have traveled before. Mm-hmm. We toured China last year.
Yeah.
And it was amazing because obviously we don't have a record distributor in China.
Mm-hmm.
But people knew the music just because they have access to online.
But what's interesting to me, Damon, about what you're saying is, you know, to follow up on Jim's point, you know, there's this sort of proud dinosaur mentality. You know, I would talk to Ian MacKay or Steve Albini, and they would say, you know, back in my day, you know, it was the old man. When I was your age, kid, I used to walk 5 miles to school in the snow. And it's the old, you know,
we used to
make our singles by hand. We used to buy the cardboard and we used to fold them together and glue them and then put them in the stores. Now it's like you can go to your bedroom and basically make a record in a day and have it distributed around the world. It's too easy. You know, a 21st century kid is going to look at you and laugh like you got to be kidding, old man. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the ease of digital is can be really wonderful. It can also be very seductive in the sense that you can fall into patterns of cliche in a different way than an analog because you can end up relying on presets, for example, to your tools. I think part of what I wanted to achieve in the book as sort of a conversation starter is to make people think about what they're surrendering to these companies and who's making some of these decisions.
Mm.
To go back to that idea of signal and noise, in the digital realm, someone else has had to decide what was signal and what was noise in any given situation because they've programmed it or they've made the platform to highlight signal and they've eliminated the noise. In analog, you always have the choice. you're always shifting your attention and you're always making that decision. And I think we're really good at making that decision. So why have Facebook make it for us? Mm. Why have Facebook decide what posts we're interested in? You know, just put it all out there. Now, when digital is used in a more open way, where the information is freely available and unsorted by corporations, then I think it's the most fantastic gift, and I fully embrace it. Anyway, there's no turning back. There's no choice. So we have to embrace it. And I just think we need to be a little bit more alert to what we may be surrendering without real compensation of any kind, either meaning or financial in some cases.
What do you tell the kid who listens to all their music on through streaming? Convenience and portability trumps all. What are they missing? What do you know? You're missing something essential, or do you say, "Have at it, kid. I can't tell you what to do."
I would say that I listen to streaming too. I think that I get something different from streaming, and I get something different from records. I get something different from CDs too, for that matter. I don't feel that any of the formats should eliminate the others. There's a lot of music in the world that is also made now, currently, to be heard streaming. I saw a great interview with a producer who's worked with Frank Ocean, who was talking about how he mixes to, you know, these beautiful speakers that cost tens of thousands of dollars, way beyond anything I've ever had access to.
A tornado flew around my room before you came. Excuse the mess it made. It usually doesn't rain in Southern California, much like Arizona. My eyes don't shed tears.
But then after he's done that, then he mixes and he listens on his PowerBook speakers, straight off the PowerBook.
As bad as it gets.
Yeah.
A tornado flew around my room before you came. Excuse the mess it made. It usually doesn't rain in Southern California, much like Arizona. My eyes don't shed tears, but boy, they pour when I'm thinking about you.
I wouldn't say to anybody, you're not hearing the music, which gets back to why the number of bit rates doesn't really matter to me that much. I would just say be aware of what aspects you're hearing of the music and what you might be losing. Mm. And then try it some other way and see what aspects you might hear then and what you might be losing. I do, like a lot of people right now, I have gone back to a lot of my vinyl collection. But I'm also buying CDs like crazy because, boy, are they cheap right now. CDs, all those box sets I couldn't afford in the 2000s. True. Man, I'm just vacuuming them up because they've got the liner notes. And the sound is great. You know, once people got a hold of how to master for CD, it was amazing.
So it improved a lot.
Do you think there's going to be a CD revival the way there is obviously a vinyl revival happening?
I kind of doubt it because they're not beautiful objects.
No.
And, you know, and they're just plastic. And they do look and feel like junk.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit perverse right now, but I am buying them for the booklets almost mostly.
Well, they're easier to carry.
Yeah, nothing's as easy to carry as nothing,
true.
Which is true.
We're moving to a post-possession world.
Yeah.
Or at the very best, everybody's going to have that one IKEA bookshelf where they have the 100 vinyl albums that define their life, the 24 hardcover books. That's my favorite. You know, I don't think this is a bad thing. We got to stop killing this planet, please. You know, but everybody should have the one IKEA bookshelf.
That kind of sense of like investment in a piece of analog media. If you buy a book, even if you don't read it, I had a great conversation with a used bookseller here at the Fine Arts Building yesterday. He was saying, you know, even if you don't read a book you buy, it's looking at you from the shelf saying, you could read this.
Yeah.
The unread book is something that you're not reading, but you could. And that's different than the streaming thing where you're only getting what you're listening to. But you have a relationship with your own records and books. You use them.
Mm-hmm.
They bear marks of your use, as you're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that deepens the relationship, if you can talk about a relationship with an object, but it deepens the meaning of the object for you because it represents time spent and also change time. You know, there are lots of records in my collection where one side meant more to me than the other, and it's gone through different phases over time.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that I think you need a physical object to really have that to bear the traces of time and of your engagement with it. And that's something that I would say to the kid who is relying on digital. It's like, that's great. I'd do it too. And you've got this incredible tool in front of you. You can reach any music in the world. Go for it. But also think about what it is to have something right in front of you and what else you get from that. And that might give you insight into the digital stuff and what you might not be getting from it. And
so the best of both worlds. Be aware absolutely. That two worlds exist.
Yeah, because they do. That's the reality. Yeah. We're using both all the time. Mm.
We've been talking to Damon Krukowski, longtime indie musician and songwriter and the author of The New Analog. Damon, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show again.
Oh, I love the show. I'm so happy to be here.
Of time, my stitch in the cauldron.
After a break, we're going to spend a little more time on this idea of thick listening. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.